Hello and welcome to Season Desist podcast. Carmel King, how are you?
I'm great, thanks Hayden. Thanks for having me.
This isn't the first time we've spoken together. The first time we spoke on a podcast, I believe.
I think so.
Yes. Yeah, for those listening, it would be unfair to say we don't know each other pretty well now. We've worked together for a lot of years and we spoke at events around the world. We've worked together. So this has been a long time coming. And I have to give you credit, Carmel, because you actually came up with the actual topic when I was thinking, how do we sort of like continue the whole Season Desist mission of, you know, sharing interesting stories, insights, tools of the trade, sort of do's and don'ts, things like that for people that work in the sector. And you had suggested the sort of insolvency as an asset recovery tool, which something very close to my heart from my former job as well. I've been involved on the practitioner side, but you're very much involved in the expert side and actually doing the stuff as the regulated person. So for those that don't know, could you introduce yourself and tell us what on earth brought you to the pinnacle of your career, which is speaking on the Season Desist podcast? What was your journey to get here?
It is. Yes. And I'm glad to see we both got the memo about the uniform today too.
Yeah, exactly.
So I'm Carmel King.
We always tell people to set them up. Oh no, we're not going to release any clips. Then we release lots of clips.
Great. Look forward to that. I'm Carmel King. I'm a partner at Grant Thornton out of London. I lead our digital asset recovery team and I'm an insolvency practitioner as well. In my career, I've always looked at fraud and financial crime and ways to recover assets for the victims of those crimes. And as you've mentioned, my team sits within the insolvency and asset recovery team. We use insolvency to a huge degree as a tool for enforcing judgments and issuing claims and generally speaking, indeed working with the public sector as well. But broadly speaking, I'm a private sector individual who tends to be involved in litigation and asset recovery, often using insolvency.
Super. So when I think about one of the main reasons we set this podcast up is because everyone that we know in our sector, people adjacent to the asset recovery sector, we all sit at conferences, we all nod along knowingly, and rarely do people have the courage to go, what do you actually do? Like, talk me through that actual thing. And if you say to someone, yeah, someone was using civil recovery powers, people go, yeah, civil recovery powers. And it was a liquidator. And in their head, they're probably going, but why would a liquidator be appointed in that case? Because it's a proceeds of crime case, for example. And things, and sort of our job is basically to ask the questions that some people might obviously know the answer to, and other people might be going, thank God, I've been waiting to have that clarification for 5 years, or I was going to ask ChatGPT, I'd much rather you guys told me about it. So in terms of thinking about the asset recovery ecosystem, the whole job about, you know, disrupting organized crime, getting assets back to people, whether that is state, civil society, or individual classes of creditors, what are the actual sort of duties of a liquidator, like the duties, the powers, what actually happens under that asset recovery umbrella when, and also how do we even get to the position where they say, this isn't just the police going in and grabbing the assets and prosecuting the suspect and taking the assets. At what stage do you start to get that first phone call? And sort of why is that with your duties and powers?
Well, I suppose it can be different stages. And the thing to say at the outset is there is a significant difference between the private sector and private asset recovery professionals more broadly, not just liquidators or insolvency practitioners and law enforcement. There are pros and cons, and there's absolutely no reason why they can't work together to get the best out of both sides of the coin. And we can talk about that a little bit later. Quite often, people will go to law enforcement, and law enforcement has the duty of justice and indeed restitution. For us, it's we're known to be expensive, obviously, and we're not always expensive, and we can be flexible and take on a huge amount of risk. But because of the cost and because we need to keep the lights on, our focus is very much on restitution. We don't have the powers to put the bad guys in jail. We have the powers to make life very uncomfortable for the bad guys, such that they either settle or we recover the assets for return to, as you say, the creditors or the victims of a crime. Civil recovery and insolvency are again two different things, and I wear the two hats really. So quite a lot of the work that I do and my team does will be litigation support. Lawyers will come to us and say, particularly in the crypto and digital asset space, we need a blockchain analytics report to support an application to court on behalf of a victim And that might be to get freezing orders, to get disclosure orders from centralized exchanges, to trace the digital assets and the crypto that's been stolen or defrauded or investment scams, fraudulent scams, you name it. And we'll do the tracing to say, yes, the assets went from A to B to C and landed at D. And that might be in litigation. It might be to go directly to the exchange. It might be to work with law enforcement. So civil litigation doesn't require a liquidator. Where we tend to get involved on as a liquidator, it can be at a similar point in proceedings or it can be much later. So there may be a claim, a financial claim that someone has against it would be an identified individual as opposed to civil litigation, which in UK and Commonwealth jurisdictions allows for persons unknown where you don't know who the bad actor is. But if you know who you're pursuing and you have a debt, a liquidated debt, and that can be a judgment or even just an invoice that hasn't been paid or something like that, when it's over a certain amount, you can make an application against an individual to make them bankrupt or against a company to put it into liquidation.
And that can also be the state. That could be the tax authority in that jurisdiction using tax powers to go after somebody, but to unlock the powers of a liquidator. It's like, I'm in the tax office. I want to raise a debt. I don't have the same international resources as you do as a civil tax authority in a far-flung jurisdiction somewhere or even in the UK. That debt can just be clear on that. That debt can also be public sector driven debt.
The public sector, certain departments in the public sector don't even need the liquidated debt. They have the powers to wind up because it's in the public interest. So the powers and actually the origins of my team and my broader insolvency and asset recovery team goes back 30 years doing a huge amount of work with HMRC.
God, you don't look it, do you?
Yeah, I know. before I arrived, I was just a child then. But it was very much when you had the VAT and the carousel fraud going on across Europe with mobile phones or platinum or medical instruments or whatever it happened to be, but it was VAT fraud. And to disrupt the criminal gangs that were involved in that, HMRC used liquidators, such as obviously my boss's bosses at the time, to go in, disrupt those chains, investigate the fraud and recover the assets through litigation and pursuing certain banks and third parties that had assisted and facilitated. So that is the origins. And yes, the public sector does use the powers to wind up for the purposes of disruption and for asset recovery as well.
As an aside, in case I forget, if the liquidator is in being appointed to wind up that company in the public interest in a case like that, again, thinking back to my old job in HMRC, but for those that don't know, if you're in and you're gathering, I can imagine lots of very valuable potential intelligence there as the guise of the person winding up that company that could be connected to a wider, most likely is in a big MTech case or any of those big cases, most likely connected to suspected organized crime groups. What's the vehicle then for you? Are you disseminating that back to the authority that appointed you and then they disseminate it internally? Or how does that intel get out or does it get out?
It does. I'm going to say yes and no in that obviously with the liquidator has a duty to gather in the assets and the books and records of the company or the individual. So certainly we have a requirement to get in everything that we have. And that might be from the company itself, although in my experience, those records are not particularly robust and tend to be left on computers which have been left out in the rain or given away or all of these, cars that get stolen and all of these unusual things. So you tend to go to third party institutions, banks, crypto exchanges nowadays, but also professional advisors, their lawyers, and even their tax records, if there are any. There do need to be appropriate gateways because whether it's an individual or a company, there are protections against self-incrimination and in the age of GDPR, obviously a liquidator has responsibility. So certainly, again, the disclosure point is turned. It works in two different directions. Certainly liquidators have obtained disclosure orders in terms of to get information from banks and from third parties, although they're not often required. And the reverse is the case for law enforcement to obtain information from liquidators. If there are appropriate gateways and they can demonstrate that they're entitled to that information, then that's possible as well. And yeah, as you say, there's absolutely no reason why a civil liquidation process can't work alongside a proceeds of crime process or a criminal enforcement process. There may be a bit of a race to the assets, but we're all working towards the same process, which is either under pocket to deprive the criminals of their assets or under the Insolvency Act, which is to gather in the assets and return them to the creditors, effectively the victims of the crime.
And ultimately then, it's sort of just like the work that Asset Reality does, your costs are then recovered from the assets?
Well, that's,
most or all of the time? Is that usually?
Well, they're certainly not paid for by anyone else. So that might be... it is obviously a really significant benefit. And then, so the first thing, the fact that we were obliged to gather in the asset, we're obliged to gather in the records, and our costs are another thing. So as a liquidator, costs are born from the estate. And again, I mentioned that our team goes way back in history in terms of doing a lot of work for HMRC and other law enforcement organizations. Those will not have been funded by those organizations. It's very much, to use an old phrase, taking the rough with the smooth. One case might have assets and one case might not have assets. And you do take those on risk. And having worked in this field for a long time, you get a feel for that. And it's a commercial decision, but it's also about evaluating the risk and looking at the route to recoveries, which might not always be 100% clear. And frankly, in my experience, is never 100% clear. But you have your company intelligence and you have your OSINT and you have all of these things that you look at from the outset and work with, whether it's an instructing lawyer or a creditor or a bank or a financial institution or law enforcement or tax authority. You look at these things together and see if it's a good use of time and resources, because otherwise we don't get paid. And as I say, focus on restitution, right? So it's very different to just making life miserable or obtaining justice on behalf of victims of a crime. For us, it is about restitution. So if we spend, £100 getting £110 back, then brilliant. If we spend £100,000 getting zero back, that's not in anyone's interest, really, is it?
And I suppose, like, I've seen both sides of it. I mean, I've seen there's an easy, and we'll come to it later, but there's an easy sort of just, no, all private asset recovery is bad. And I think no one's advocating for, no, Carmel King to be able to decide who gets prosecuted in the future and what assets get frozen in the future. But there is, but I've also seen the other times where maybe without a clear strategy in place, a large government agency appoints an insolvency practitioner or a law firm to just go off on a bit of a folly, ramp up massive fees and actually the returns aren't there. But then similarly, law enforcement has the same challenge. Not every case where all the intelligence is developed and executed and arrested, and some of the enormous like UWO cases and some of the big cases that NCA and SFO have had that have ultimately not been successful outcomes, it doesn't mean they weren't right in trying or pursuing them. Because otherwise, if you look at everything on an entirely risk-based approach and be like, oh, maybe we shouldn't, then we wouldn't take on any cases, candidly. Mm-hmm. And what I want to come to in a second, the unique part of digital asset recovery, you guys know better than many, with things like in the public domain, Cryptopia and other cases. And we see this with MTGOX. And whereas it's one of the few industries in the world where all of the assets that were seized 10, 5, 2, 3 years ago are actually appreciating in value so much that now people are arguing over surpluses. And we've never really seen that in traditional asset recovery. But sticking with the sort of theme of, so government agencies can go ahead, and again, our audience is predominantly public sector. So government agencies might be sitting in a jurisdiction now where they just simply do not have the resources in a massive corruption case to take on some sort of international investigation, where they have a small team. And actually the best thing might be the government saying, right, we now are going to go after this particular individual. We have a claim against the person. They're a billionaire with a complicated asset portfolio around the world. We want to appoint a liquidator, or we're going to consider bringing in someone to go after these assets. What are the sort of the powers that maybe a lot of people don't realize that a liquidator has, just to sort of to run through them, just to give us a bit of an insight into what is capable. And I'm obviously talking about asset recovery cases where the gloves are off, like not some poor person that's unfortunately been victim of just a third party debt. I'm on about worst of humanity, and we're trying to use all the different tools in the toolkit to go after them.
And we've been involved in quite a few of those. And you're absolutely right. I think where liquidators have the advantage, it is the powers that we have, and I'll mention those in a minute, but it's also the resources that we have, because we have the ability to sink funds into this, and the international reach and the speed that we have as well, because civil litigation, and as you know, I've got a background in doing quite a bit of proceeds of crime work, again on the private side, and as enforcement receiverships and management receiverships and that kind of thing. So I'm familiar with the pain points that law enforcement feel when they have to do an MLAT, or something like that. You might as well kind of throw a bit of paper in a black hole sometimes in terms of the time it's going to take.
Oh, yeah. A lot of MLATs, for those that don't know, are measured in years to get information back. Like not days and weeks, years to get information out. Even if you get the information you've asked for. In the end.
And so if you have, a former mayor of Sao Paulo, for example, which is one case that we dealt with, which was a big corruption case, who's very well funded, who has assets tied up in trusts in the Caribbean, in the Isle of Man, Jersey, Guernsey, and all of these, this big trail of complex organizations and complex structures to obfuscate and to hide assets, that can be a really, really long slog if each jurisdiction is going to take months or years to provide information to you, never mind actually untangling it and litigating and prosecuting. For us, we have the benefit of investigative powers, discovery, and third-party interviews and demanding information from third parties.
I think some police would be surprised to know that you can command people to come in for an interview or even have them examined.
Yep. And it's all specified and set down in the Insolvency Act. It's not a case of you're not entitled to go out on a fishing expedition. And there are properly and rightfully some limits on what you can do. But professional advisors, and that can be lawyers, the accountants, that kind of thing, they're obliged to provide their information, their files, and potentially come in for interview depending. Officers of companies, obviously the directors themselves, and indeed related parties. There are different provisions around related parties and family members who have received gifts and transfers of ownership of assets and all kinds of things like that. So we've got huge powers of investigation and discovery. And that includes on the cross-border side. So again, because a liquidator and because there are various forms of insolvency acts all over the world, or there's UNSA trial, there's the ability to have your appointment recognized.
What's UNSA trial?
Oh, it's a UN organization, which effectively has I'm not going to talk about standardization because every country has different insolvency rules and regulations and laws, but it allows for member companies to recognize and to have commonality. And so there is an eternal question around harmonization of insolvency laws, and I won't go into it across Europe in particular. But where you have members of UNSA trial, there's the ability, and there's a huge number, there's the ability to seek and obtain recognition. There are certain jurisdictions where you have automatic recognition. So it's a case of going in and being able to exercise those powers in a completely different jurisdiction.
So just to be clear then, so you're operating out of UK Insolvency Act of, it is 1986 or something. You're using the Insolvency Act. You're appointed in Brazil. Are your powers from the Insolvency Act of the UK, or are you almost being like sworn in Brazil to use their Insolvency Act? Let's say there was a power that was on the UK side that didn't exist in Brazil. Does it travel?
There does need to be commonality.
Okay.
Certainly. So we've had cases where something that might be an offence under insolvency legislation in the UK, which would mean that a liquidator could litigate with the purpose of recovering assets, wasn't recognised as an offence. In my case, it was Switzerland. And so we were limited in terms of what we could bring. And it meant we had to think outside the box. But there are
Can you go to court for like a direction and say, we want to do this?
You could potentially.
Is that normally the resolution?
Yeah. But, it does get complicated where different jurisdictions have different tax regulations, for example, and something that might be an offence under tax regulations in the UK might not be in Switzerland, not to speak of ill of Switzerland. I'm sure it has incredibly well developed.
Yeah, everyone will have different things,
But everyone has different things.
All our fans in Switzerland.
Yes, it was a wonderful experience. No, and we've had huge success in Switzerland, actually, because you have the ability to bring criminal and civil proceedings simultaneously, even without the engagement of law enforcement. So Switzerland aside, you do need to have commonality of the concept that you're trying to litigate. But that does bring me on to litigation. So there are really broad powers. You can sue related parties. You can sue facilitators of fraud or financial crime. You can sue people who have dishonestly assisted. You can sue people who knew or should have known that they were facilitating a fraud or financial crime. You can sue people for fraud. And a litigator or a liquidator can bring all of those claims with a view to restoring the estate to the position that it would have been in had it not happened. And so where you have directors who are not acting in the interests of the company and creditors who are victims of that and who are out of pocket because of that, that's incredibly powerful. Creditors also have oversight of it as well, to a degree, if not influence, because liquidators report to the creditors. Creditors can be required to give sanction for certain things. So it's a really collaborative, unlike law enforcement, where you might report a crime or report an issue and it gets absorbed and law enforcement will go off and do their own thing. And for reasons that are very obvious, they won't be able to reply to the victims and give them an update on everything that's happening. A liquidator is more able to work in tandem and hand in hand with victims of fraud and financial crime and give them some insight into what's happening and what the strategy might be.
Because this is where my head was going with all of this, is that when you listen to, you know, someone like Erin West, you know, the one woman army at sort of Operation Shamrock, now, who's just raised, brought so much attention to this sort of like the plight of victims in these, you know, specifically sort of crypto fraud cases, just because the vehicle of crypto makes it just, it puts it in a more difficult box. And the harsh reality that the vast majority of law enforcement, because of successive government cuts around the world, most law enforcement didn't. Very, very rarely you meet a government agency that's like, yay, we have all the funding we need, we have all the officers we need, we have all the tools and training we need, we're good. Now, we deal with every case that comes across our desk. That's just not the world we live in. So I'm trying to reconcile in my head and get your view on it. Is it knowledge? Is it apprehension? Like, it seems to me, and again, I'm not trying to be a private sector asset recovery fanboy, but I'm just trying to be really practical. Why is it? Is it the cost, basically? Is that the barrier? Because if I think that, I know as a cases we're involved in normally, if someone comes along and says to me, you have a victim in the UK and it's a corrupt politician or someone linked and running this dodgy Ponzi scheme promising big crypto returns, and all of a sudden when you map it out, there's four jurisdictions involved. It sounds to me that actually knowing that if it's a normal amount and it's not a political headline grabbing case, I wouldn't expect the normal law enforcement in my jurisdiction, and this we see planted across the US, I'm not expecting that law enforcement agency to say, great, I'm going to map all of this out, I'm going to fly to six different countries, I'm going to be hauling in enablers and the people, as you say, that were connected to the companies that facilitated the flow of funds. And so you've got all of these powers that seems almost too good to be true in an Insolvency Act setting. Is it just basically the economics, that these costs, because they are big, large, complicated, multinational cases, that unless you've lost hundreds of thousands of pounds and the prize to recover isn't in the millions, it's highly unlikely that the person who's lost the money in the first place is going to be able to say, here's a fighting fund of $500,000, do your worst. Is it the economics, or do you think governments could do more in finding ways, because everyone talks about public and private sector partnership, but I don't see lots of cases where it's, and most countries have Proceeds of Crime Act with civil, with civil recovery and sort of appointing enforcement receivers. What do you think is the barrier why we're not seeing like dozens and dozens and dozens of cases like this, where the remedy is just like, we don't have the resources, we're going to get one of these folks appointed for you? What do you think is the barrier to that? And maybe I'm being naive, but educate
me. I'd never describe you as naive, Aidan. I think, although we don't have all day, it is a multitude of factors.
To describe my naivety.
We'll get into that in a second.
But I can imagine whether I'm a victim of a scam or I'm a regular cop sitting somewhere going, why the hell do we not just use this then? What's the issue?
The question I most often get asked is, what's the threshold? And I give the infuriating answer of, it depends. So putting insolvency and liquidation as a power aside, because you're right, it does need to be the right case. And for us to put significant time on the clock at risk, there does need to be a significant pot of gold at the end of the rainbow, even if we can't quite see the rainbow. And obviously, if the view is and the aim is to return the assets to creditors, that needs to be an extra large pot, because I mean, only we gain, really, if it's all absorbed in costs. And I can see how that's not an attractive proposition for law enforcement to say, right, well, the lawyers and the accountants are doing well out of this, but the victims aren't placed in a better position. Yeah. So I can understand that. I think law enforcement is, as you say, not as well funded as we all wish it was. And so they quite often, certainly from my conversations with the likes of the NCA, for example, have a focus on disruption. So they're looking at the darknet markets, for example, and some really good examples of them collaborating with law enforcement internationally and doing takedowns. They're not dealing with Mr. A coming in off the street who's lost £150,000 or Mr. B who's lost $500,000.
Yeah,
or anything
it's
like
work
that.
And they use their limited resources for the biggest impact.
Exactly. And we have the ability to do that, but it has to be the right case. I have anything up to 20 people, I would say, a week directly approaching me, having lost crypto in particular to various investment scams, or they're in the middle of a scam, or they're being told that their assets can be recovered.
Or they're a victim being rescammed.
And they're a victim being rescammed by someone pretending effectively to be an organization such as mine or from CIFAR, the organization that you and I are founder members of. And for them, there are, unfortunately, obviously we respond to all of them and get involved with and engage with all of them. But there are very few that we can meaningfully engage with because it's a balance between the loss and the complexity, frankly, of the tracing and of the legal case. Mm. Some years ago now, we were involved in the case of Law versus Persons Unknown, and we did the blockchain analytics tracing, the litigation support in that. And the loss was, from memory, about $150,000 worth of Bitcoin. So you would say, theoretically, and lots of my peers would say, we couldn't even look at that. And we did look at it, and we were able to get a recovery in full because the tracing was incredibly simple. So the work that we did wasn't cost heavy at all. Mm. The litigation was straightforward. It was in England. It didn't need to be moved overseas. We didn't need to get recognition in another jurisdiction. And the exchange, we managed to get the funds frozen at the exchange, and the exchange cooperated. Now, if we had another case where the tracing was incredibly complex and it took us 2 or 3 weeks to do that, we're on significant risk there. The application to court in England and Wales, and depending on your loss level, can be over £10,000. That's a hard cost. That's not lawyers. That's court fees. And then if you have exchanges that don't cooperate or assets that haven't been frozen, so effectively you're just looking at phase one. So I think it's more a case of having to evaluate it from the very outset. And that's where people like you and me get involved. Getting involved in the outset is really important because we look at it from recovery, whereas, you know, others might look at where they might slot in the process, but you really have to look at it from start to finish. I'm not going to do a blockchain analytics report if it's not going to be useful, because there's no point in me getting paid for that piece of work and then it going nowhere. I work with lawyers who are not going to take on a job unless they can see it going all the way to recovery. I'm not going to take on an enforcement piece unless I know I can do justice to it. But other organizations, and none come to mind, but it's just about putting together a team that is looking at getting not just a judgment, which is a piece of paper, into a victim's hand, but getting a recovery into the victim's hand.
It's literally why we exist. You know, we talk about like the recovery and asset recovery. There's absolutely no comfort to a victim going, oh yeah, we got an unenforceable judgment overseas. Yeah. We traced all of those assets. It's like the lady in the Titanic going, yeah, we can see it's down there, the big jewel you dropped. But like, there's just no way of getting it back. And I actually was speaking to, again, another tragic case where, I mean, we don't work for victims directly. We support law enforcement, but people still reach out on LinkedIn. And I always give the same example. As painful as it sounds, if you were fortunate enough to own a £50,000 watch and someone snatched it off you in central London and disappeared into the crowd, what would the remedy be? Mm. You go to the police station, you tell the police, I've just lost my asset. Do you really expect that the police are going to jump over the desk, hit the flashing blue lights, and be like, shut down the airport, close the tunnel, get all the CCTV? They're just going to say, that's awful. We're very sorry. Are you okay? Let's fill the report in. Maybe they can take a bit of a look at some of the CCTV. They can see the person disappearing onto the tube line. It's like they could be anywhere in London right now. And every time, as brutal as it sounds, and it's almost that perspective piece that if it didn't happen to you, you'd probably say, well, of course they can't do anything. But the minute it happens to you or a loved one, it's like, why isn't people doing more? And that's why we're a big advocate for, I mean, one of the reasons why we all work together in things like CIFAR is because we know that there are so many desperate people being re-victimized again. And we'll include in the show notes the sort of link to CIFAR that, mm-hmm. I mean, the only way you can really do this safely is by going to regulated entities. You're an insolvency practitioner, you have regulatory oversight. Yeah. You know, we sit under the purview under money laundering regulations by being registered with the FCA. And we always tell people, anyone you're working with, it's like, again, person steals the Rolex. Are you going to Google, get my Rolex back, and have some X, the former private investigator going, sure, I can go and check all the CCTV. It's going to cost you X. Like, what is the actual chances of recovery? But to flip it on its head, we have seen the opposite. We have seen in crypto, because of the inherent traceability of the blockchain, of assets on the blockchain, that there are these astonishing recovery cases where someone has lost some crypto assets. You know, and we always tell people, go and declare your loss, report it everywhere. Because you just never know. You might be that person that a couple of years down the line, your funds have ended up at an exchange somewhere. The exchange has collapsed. Someone's got all the funds and now they're doing a distribution. One of the things we're most commonly asked about, and as we're recording this today, you know, the news headline right now in the UK is all about, you know, what it looks like the largest single crypto seizure ever. Not the largest in terms of quantity, because Silk Road had a 69,000 Bitcoin case, but certainly in terms of value, $7 billion worth. One of the big questions is, what happens in a normal, inverted commas, no such thing as normal, but in a normal case where someone has lost their assets? Can you give us those couple of scenarios where a victim of a scam, for example, loses assets and someone like yourself is appointed and you're tracing and you find assets versus someone puts in Bitcoin, gets their wallet hacked and they lose their asset? What are the different couple of remedies? Because the people will have heard about getting paid back in specie. And but what does that mean? And that all of these things aren't crypto specific. These are good old fashioned like insolvency remedies that have, and litigation remedies that have been around for a long time. Could you just sort of walk us through that? What it looks like from someone loses assets to someone getting their assets back, the different ways that can happen.
I can, yeah. And I'm conscious that we're talking about almost two different things when we talk about civil recovery and liquidators, but obviously liquidators use civil recovery. But to touch on a point that you made earlier about, you know, the person on the street losing their wallet, or their watch rather, I think there is a bit of a blame game that is going around. We blame victims for dabbling in a sector that is largely unregulated, that, you know, not all of it is fraud or financial crime. A huge part of the sector that we both work in is entirely legitimate. But we blame victims for their losses. We blame law enforcement for not being able to deal with everyone who walks in off the street. We blame the private sector for being too expensive and almost, you know, trying to cynically take advantage of victims. We blame the government for not prioritizing fraud and scams, although the government did designate fraud and scams as a national security threat in 2024. So it can't just be the responsibility of law enforcement or government or public sector institutions to deal with what everyone's been calling an epidemic of fraud for many years now. I do think it's the responsibility of private sector organizations such as yours and mine to get involved, and for education to be a huge part of it as well. But to answer your question about what happens, I think on the civil recovery side, taking a crypto example, I can give you the case of Mr. A that we dealt with in the back end of last year. And he was an individual who'd been diagnosed with cancer. He was his wife's carer. She had Alzheimer's. And in order to deal with his own treatment, he was unfortunately had to place his wife in a home. And he was looking to fund it. And in all of these stories that we see, obviously, he clicked on a link, invested a certain amount, saw the returns, invested more and more and more, found that he had lost over £500,000, I think it was. I know. And obviously at an incredibly vulnerable time of life and entire life savings. And I don't think in this case he had taken out borrowings on top of that, but certainly you and I have both seen that as well. We were engaged by the law firm that he instructed. And using a new section of POCA, the Proceeds of Crime Act, it's section 303Z51, I believe, for all of the... Yep, exactly. But what had happened was, at the same time, in a really good example of public and private sector collaboration, if not partnership, it wasn't partnership, but the Met Police had already been involved and had not directly on behalf of Mr. A, but on behalf of other victims that had managed to freeze assets. So we all went to court together. And using our tracing report, which was it used Equitable tracing, which is relatively unusual in this space. But the point is that again, you need someone who has a forensic approach to this tracing exercise. You can't just come up with any old rubbish trying to connect yourself to assets that have been frozen as a victim. We were able to get 100% recovery for Mr. A from those funds that have been frozen. Now, that is an oversimplified and very, very good outcome for the victim. And obviously, our costs were paid, the lawyer's costs were paid, funds remain. So in terms of the Met Police's seizure, in terms of there being funds available, whether those go for investing in law enforcement or go to the Crown or go to other victims of that fraud, there remain funds available and frozen. And that action continues, as far as I'm aware. That was a really, really good outcome. It doesn't mean that that's the outcome all the time, because if it wasn't difficult, we wouldn't be involved, right? You know, if it was easy, there'd be no requirement to have us.
Well, yeah, and the same way every reported crime isn't successfully sort of dealt with. But just a point on that, the procedurally, I know that would have made some people's ears prick up. So are there situations where, I mean, how can a law firm and an insolvency practitioner use the Proceeds of Crime Act? Because most people would have assumed that the Proceeds of Crime Act is only something that can be a police case that is started and then they bring you in, so to speak. Are there avenues that you can just directly make an application as a law firm on behalf of a victim, or does there have to be that police, law enforcement nexus?
That's a really good question. And actually, in this case and in another one that we're engaged on at the moment, the answer is no. The law firm can bring a private prosecution.
This is what people know as private prosecution cases. Mm-hmm.
Yep. And it is under the Proceeds of Crime Act. There is the ability for law enforcement or the Crown Prosecution Service, I think, to engage if they believe it's in the public interest for them to step in. But there are certain law firms who are specialised in Proceeds of Crime Act, private prosecution.
Yeah, we've seen a lot of, I think I bump into enough on the circuit. At some point, I'm going to have to extend an invite to the guys at EMM Legal.
Absolutely.
Because we're constantly talking about cases. So
they're doing huge work in this space. In fairness to them, they're doing excellent work. And
if Ashley or Tom is listening, we'll have to... You're up next.
I'll pick up my fiver after. Yeah.
but it's true. But again, point of this podcast is for people to be like, oh, I didn't actually know that, but I've heard about it discussed for a long time. I'm sure a lot of people will be surprised that, and even people who hear the word private prosecution will probably think it's some special weird legislation and not realize it is the same legislation that regular police officers use on a day-to-day basis in proceeds of crime cases.
Yeah, absolutely. And as I say, it's something I have some experience of, but certainly the guys at EMM and a limited number of other law firms have much more direct and deep experience of. And to go back to your point about in specie distributions, that's an interesting point in liquidations and in this space. And I won't talk at length about it, but there is a question there, and I don't think it's been finally solved. In certain American liquidations, the date of crystallization has been taken as the date of liquidation, which leaves everyone else.
Yeah. Well, I was just going to say, because this is we could lose some people here if they don't know these, or maybe I just haven't done a good enough job framing the request. But you know me well enough to know what I'm actually trying to talk about. So a common question that I get when we're doing any government training or anything like that is, let's say I have a criminal, or I have a victim of a large Ponzi scheme, and that victim has paid US dollars into this scheme. And what's really unique about crypto right now is that it's one of the few asset classes in the world where you're actually dealing with appreciating, albeit volatile, but the overall trend is I lose assets in 2014, 2015, and now in 2024 or 2025, my $100,000 that I lost is now worth $1 million. And we're seeing some cases where people who have lost assets, now those assets are worth 10x or 100x more. But it's worthwhile just explaining to people the difference between putting in cash and whether the criminal or the gang has then changed your asset class and you don't have the same claim necessarily. But maybe give us the easy version first. So the cleanest version is when you invest Bitcoin, they take your Bitcoin, but it takes 5 years to get it back. You get your Bitcoin back effectively, regardless of the value. Is that correct?
All going well. Certainly in one matter where I'm appointed liquidator, we did exactly that. There was no fraud or financial crime in this case. It was an orderly wind down of a company that no longer wanted to be in jurisdiction. The difference in that case was that there were sufficient assets for all claimants in the liquidation. So if I have 100 cents in the dollar to give to everyone, I'll give them their 100 cents in the dollar. And that means I can do what's called an in-specie distribution, which is easier for me. I don't have to incur the costs and the risks of converting the crypto. If someone wants their one Bitcoin back, they can have their one Bitcoin. I think a significant thing to understand is that crypto is not cash or cash equivalent yet. That hasn't been determined in any court that I'm aware of. And okay. So it's property. And if you're putting that in, it's up to a liquidator or a court to determine the value of that. And that value might be the date that the company went under. It might be the date maybe of your claim. It might be some other date. And that's why I think on FTX.
It's not uniform yet. That's the issue. It is varying on a case and jurisdiction by jurisdiction basis. Okay.
So I think with cases like MT Gox and FTX, there were certain interest payments that didn't necessarily make creditors whole if you take into account the appreciation of the asset. But perhaps the court would argue that you're not entitled to the appreciation. You're just entitled to the value that you've lost.
They got more than what they lost.
Yeah. So it really does vary from jurisdiction to jurisdiction, and you have to be quite careful about that. If I don't have enough assets in a case, so if we're talking about just cash or I've sold a house or whatever, and I've got enough to pay creditors 80 cents in the dollar, then you're unlikely to be getting back your Bitcoin, right? And if you're talking about on a portfolio where we have 700 different tokens across 250,000 different creditors, which is like a case we're dealing with at the moment, it's very hard to work out 80% of your Bitcoin and your Cardano and your ETH and your all of those kinds of things. So be prepared, I think, at least for a USDT distribution.
That's a really important procedural point. So at that stage, then it is almost on the merits of each case in each jurisdiction. You're having to come up with and is that something that the insolvency practitioner would just get creditor support on, or would you have to go to court additionally for direction? Or if you and the creditors are all happy, happy families, if you and the creditors are all aligned?
It would vary. We've certainly had cases not involving crypto, but where there have been a limited number of creditors and everyone agrees and everyone's happy. Other cases where you need to give creditors, and if you have 250,000 creditors, or in the case of Cryptopia, as you say, that's complicated slightly further by there being a legal construct of trusts dividing up all of the assets. And I won't bore you with that, but 900,000 odd creditors, it's probably better to get the direction of the court, which also gives the opportunity for creditors to have their opinions.
So you're covered in your decision making. Yeah. So in that case, then it is a bit of hopefully common sense prevailing, where it's a case of, we think that this is the most fair and equitable way to distribute the estate. This is the quantum by which we're calculating your particular claim, Aidan, and we think that you're owed X. And if I really am angry about it, I will go to court. I'll argue with you. I'll do whatever I can. But at least it, because I think that's what's being debated and being played out in the press at the minute around the big Chinese Bitcoin case in London. It's a case of, if you put in cash, do you get cash back? Or, and I guess, not to put you on the spot, I don't know what the answer is to this, but in the likes of, Bernie Madoff cases and cases like that, it was, are you entitled to what the portfolio made, or do you just get your original amount back? And I guess fundamentally, by the sounds of things, by what you've just said, there isn't currently this is what the generally accepted principle is globally. So this case could just be heard on its own merits and could be a very individual agreement that could be reached that may not be the same that's in another case in years to come.
I think it's hugely interesting, and it depends by jurisdiction as well. Remember, in jurisdictions like England and Wales, there's no damages concept. So if you're claiming or you might not be able to convince the court that if you had access to your assets while they were locked up in the liquidation, you would have done A, B and C. So that's
That's interesting. Yes, and then that sort of covers that first claim point where I put in 100 grand, it's now worth 1 million. If I'd have had my asset, I would have invested and I would have.
Yeah,
exactly. But then does the reverse work then? Because what they've demonstrated categorically is my 100,000 is now worth 1 million, because that's the open market price of the Bitcoin.
It's going to be incredibly interesting to see how the case that you've referred to plays out, because there are several factors at play. Obviously, we're post guilty plea now. We're pre-sentencing. There is no confiscation yet. And as you and I know, the proceeds of crime, that the process of the criminal process is a confiscation order where they evaluate how much actual proceeds of crime were and how much is available to meet that. And after that, victims can apply for what's called a compensation order. And the value of that is far from being agreed. But on the same side, you have civil litigants and a number of law firms across London representing victims in that investment scam. And I think there are no liquidations or insolvencies or bankruptcies around at the moment. And that goes exactly to what you're talking about, because the victims and their lawyers are looking at producing claims that maximize the return to victims. They don't want to have the value crystallized necessarily at a certain point in time, or that point in time being when they made the investment. There are limits to
fascinating.
Yeah, it's incredibly fascinating. And I should point out at this point that I'm not a lawyer. I am an insolvency practitioner rather than a lawyer.
No one thinks that anyway. but you are right. Well, what it does reiterate is that even in 2025, you know, crypto's been around for a while now, I still think that most people should take comfort from the fact that there is still new ground all the time in these types of cases. And even if this case goes a particular way, that doesn't automatically mean it's exactly how all of the other cases are going to be treated in future. Because, you know, since the dawn of time, we've been arguing about these sorts of issues and topics. And you, as you mentioned, we've got things in the past like commonality and standardization. We've got CARF coming in. We've got the new MiCA rules coming in. We've got like one of the quickly to get your view, like it must be complicated when you've got an international borderless asset class, but you as a regulated entity are trying to like traverse all the different jurisdictions going, oh, you're allowed to do this in this country, but not this country. If I take an instruction over here, I've got these data protection rules that are very different than Australia, than in Europe, than in the US, for example. I mean, is that sort of stuff keep you awake at night, or is that just par for the course? And
it's what's so exciting about it, right? I mean, I've got appointments in Bermuda and BVI. I've got cases going in Gibraltar and in Canada and all over the place. And it's not necessarily the jurisdictional risk that keeps me awake at night. It is that combination of, we're pushing the envelope here. We're creating new case law. We're creating new ways of dealing with a new asset class and bringing trust and integrity into the system, right? Because what we're working at is combating fraud and trying to institute rails. And some of that will work well and some of it will fail because you're at the absolute vanguard of trying to do this and set it up. But you have to do something. And I think in the last few years, there's been so much case law that has been for the benefit of victims of fraud and financial crime. I see so much of my fellow insolvency practitioners moving from saying, oh, that crypto, that's just going to disappear. It's all just fraud and scam stuff to actually, getting appropriate training. And instituting infrastructure like your platform that they need to assist them. 5 years ago, if any of my insolvency practitioner colleagues, across the UK or across the world were appointed on a case, I don't know what they would have done or where they would have placed the assets. And nowadays, it's Cryptopia in 2019. My colleagues will tell you there were no custodians then. There was no platform,
especially for the spread of tokens as well.
But
it's an interesting point. I mean, people should not be surprised that in 2025 there's still people at day one, and there will be next year and the year after that. So just know, and that's why I think it's a wonderful point for us to conclude on, because that sort of a can-do attitude, I mean, that's kind of the whole point of your job. Your job, and we spoke to Jessica Stanfield a couple of days ago as a lawyer in Canada, going like, again, my old cliche example I always use in presentations, you don't need to train to be a gemologist to seize a diamond or to be involved in litigation. And that's what I love about your industry. And obviously I've worked with insolvency practitioners in the past as my boss. I love the industry because it's like, you don't get the choice. It hits your desk and it's like, oh, tomorrow it's a petting zoo. And the day after investment banker. And the day after it's a crypto exchange. And that's the message we try and get to law enforcement to say, look, it's just another asset category, but just being the asterisks, there'll be 1,000 nuances, but we're kind of used to this as asset recovery practitioners. We're used to transversing. You know, one day it could be a haulage company. The next day, like I say, it's a, you know, it's a mining operation. And I mean actual mining of like minerals. And I think that that's the one thing people can take comfort from, because as people press on and get a success story, on one side, it helps on the disruption narrative and a bit of like positivity that you can actually get your stuff back. But it's also coupled with like this, the harsh reality of where we are right now, that like getting the stolen Rolex back, it sometimes comes down to that sort of cost benefit analysis going, are you going to spend the money and invest the money? I mean, what do you think then, sort of future gazing, to sort of take us home? Like, what, I have heard the term public and private partnership a thousand times. I'm sick of it, but it's also so important. Like, in your instance, you're queen for a day. I mean, what do you think? And please be selfish as an insolvency practitioner. You're not going to say, oh yeah, let's not do any of it. Of course, people will expect you to say, we should do more of this. What is the most like responsible playbook that you see that you'd be like, oh, if that could happen every day, I think we can get the right balance. Like, what does good look like? And what would you, for the law enforcement people listening or the decision makers in different countries who are considering or maybe apprehensive about bringing in the sort of the private sector, what do you think is a good playbook for them to use?
I think it's engagement. So the best agencies that I'm speaking to are the ones that will have open conversations and create proper gateways for the disclosure of information and all of those kinds of things, but being open to that discussion and without overcomplicating things with tender processes that tend to be a race to the bottom. In back in the olden days, it was use the best firm, the most qualified firm for the job. So a firm of my size is going to be good for the global complex things. You know, a different insolvency practitioner would be good for a more simple and straightforward thing that law enforcement still might not have capacity to handle or the expertise to handle. And I think it's about the fact that we're all people, right? And we're all heading in the same direction trying to do it. And it's about having that trust that we're not, the private sector is not trying to rip off either the public sector or the victims. We've all got the same goals in mind. And if we can deprive criminals of their ill-gained assets and with that achieve justice and return assets to the victims of those crimes, then everybody wins, right?
Yeah, that's the perfect outcome. And I do want to add a line. Let's be absolutely clear. When we say private asset recovery, we are not talking about the sort of scalp companies that will target people and say, we can get your crypto back. I think I speak for Carmel and for CIFAR in our network. Anyone that says we can guarantee a return is lying. There is no such thing as a guaranteed return. Effectively, anyone asking you for insanely upfront fees, my advice to everybody is there is a heavily regulated sector that does this sort of work. That's one of the reasons we set up CIFAR as a not-for-profit, to bring together practitioners. But if you're starting off with a law firm or insolvency practitioners that are fundamentally accountants and auditors under, you know, sort of regulatory bodies, that should always be the first conversation. If you meet someone on LinkedIn or on X that promises returns and you just need to send them some money for a tracing report, it's 99% of times always going to lead to bad outcomes. So we'll do a plug for CIFAR and others there as well. Because that is probably the cruelest thing when you come across these people that have just been defrauded twice. Carmel, thank you so much for your time. I promise to keep this under 1 hour. I'm amazed at myself that I have. And I think the fact that your door hasn't been knocked and my door hasn't been knocked and we've had no disruptions, I'm going to quit while we're ahead.
Absolutely.
Thank you so much for joining us and for sharing the insights. And I look forward to doing this again in another year's time. And we can hear about, oh, that other big case has been concluded now. We have a playbook. It's all super easy.
Great. No problem.
Thanks for your time. Cheers, Nye.
Thank you.
Our podcasts are for informational purposes only. They are not intended to provide legal, tax, financial, and/or investment advice. Listeners must consult their own advisors before making any decisions on the topics being discussed.